This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. SARS is a 21st century epidemic that many countries are responding to with the age-old tactics of quarantine and isolation. In China, where the disease began, officials imposed a strict quarantine in Beijing. In Canada, the province of Ontario asked anyone with even one symptom to stay home over the Easter weekend. In Singapore, everyone suspected of being infected has been confined to their home, and to make sure, police are monitoring some of them with web cameras and electronic bracelets. It's beginning to look as if these and other measures are working to control the spread of the SARS virus. Just today, the World Health Organization lifted the travel advisory on Toronto, saying it was satisfied that local measures had contained the virus. If this does not get any worse, it looks as if the United States will have gotten off very lightly. And maybe this situation gives us the opportunity to look at how we might handle such a public health crisis without the fear that might accompany a major outbreak. What laws do we have that deal with the containment of a major epidemic? How much power do public health officials have to declare quarantines? How do medical privacy and personal choice enter the equation? And when do the needs of the many outweigh the needs or even the rights of the individual? Later this hour, Charles Osgood joins us to talk about his new book of funny letters from famous people. But first, quarantine civil liberties and the law. How far would you go to prevent the spread of contagious disease? Would you stay home voluntarily? What if you were ordered to or told to go to a confinement center? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Lawrence Gostin, a law professor and a public health professor at Georgetown University. He also directs the Center for Law and the Public's Health, a joint project of Johns Hopkins and Georgetown Universities. It's good of you to come in.
It's my pleasure.
First of all, remind us about the origin of the word quarantine.
Quarantines go back all the way to biblical times when lepers were quarantined. It's actually means 40 days, and during olden times, before we knew about infectious diseases, you would just isolate somebody for a period of time, quarantine meaning 40 days. If they didn't become sick within that 40-day period, then you would let them in to
ships,
your city.
Ships approaching Venice.
Maritime quarantines were very common in those days.
Now, there were a lot of draconian quarantine laws on the books in the old days because that was the only way people knew how to stop what were terrible diseases.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, quarantine, as I say, goes back to biblical times, and you can actually trace the history of infectious diseases in Europe and the United States. And it's important to think about the fact that as early as 20th century New York, one out of every three hospital beds were devoted to tuberculosis and other infectious diseases. And so you can go back to plague, smallpox, cholera, all the way through to polio and then to tuberculosis, West Nile virus, and here we are with SARS.
Now, some of these seemingly draconian measures, I guess they're still on the books, aren't they?
Yeah, they are on the books. I mean, we have simply a morass of law to do with public health, and they were just built up over the ages ever since, so I would say, the 19th century through to the 20th century with new diseases emerging with new laws, and so now they're antiquated, they're inconsistent, but many of them do allow quarantine, at least for some diseases.
And enforcement of things that really we wouldn't think of. I mean, in reading for this program, some of the research, policemen in Boston sitting on someone while he was administered the smallpox vaccine.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, one of the greatest Supreme Court cases in the history of public health law had to do with the requirement to compel a resident of Cambridge, Massachusetts to take the smallpox vaccine, and the Supreme Court upheld it.
Now, you have written a model law that intended to be a template for states around the country to modernize some of these rather older statutes. So what prompted that?
Well, after September 11th and then the anthrax outbreak through the U.S. Postal Service, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, asked me and my Center for Law and the Public's Health to draft a Model Emergency Health Powers Act. And we were somewhat reluctant to do it, but we were told that if we didn't, that the states would do it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought it's better to have the kind of expertise that we did have. We wrote the law in conjunction with the federal government and also in consultation with governors and public health commissioners. And it's now been enacted in whole or part in 22 states and the District of Columbia.
Now, how is what your model law proposes different from what exists in many places?
Well, first of all, it provides all the powers that the public health authority would need in terms of vaccination, treatment, quarantine, isolation. It also allows them to gain access to pharmaceuticals, vaccines, hospital beds, and the like. And current laws don't do all that. They may apply to smallpox, but not SARS, mm-hmm. just for example. And then secondly, and just as importantly, these old laws really predate modern constitutional law. And so probably a good majority of them would be unconstitutional. And so this model law is a constitutionally sound law. So it provides, on the one hand, decisive strong powers, and on the other hand, constitutionally appropriate safeguards.
And the critical area, I guess, is exactly that, the balance between, individual rights with the overall health of the public.
I mean, that is. I mean, one of the things that actually surprised me, or I probably shouldn't have been surprised, was how venomous the attack was on the model law, both from the political left and the political right. The civil libertarians argued that there should be no quarantine, no violation of privacy, and that literally volunteers would do the job and you didn't need any kind of public health powers.
Well, let's address that first.
Sure.
Why not?
Absolutely. Well, why not? The reason is that I do believe that the majority of people would comply with public health advice, but not everyone will, and I can't think of one epidemic in our history where everybody did, including the SARS epidemic now. In Canada and other places, people didn't obey the quarantine order. They went to schools, they went to work. And it only is common sense to say that if a person has an infectious disease and they decide that they're going to go to a theater or a stadium or to work or to school, that the government can't allow that. And we can't have kind of hyper-individualism and rights rhetoric trump the common good, because you need an appropriate balance.
And the attack from the political right?
And the attack from the political right was much the same way. Don't force us to do anything. We'll volunteer. And basically, they argued that they have private property rights, that there should be, if they have dangerous property, that it couldn't be destroyed, that their private property in terms of vaccines and hospital beds and pharmaceuticals was off base for the government. And again, this isn't part of the history and tradition of America. We're starting to lose that tradition of the common good, and we need to recapture it.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. What concerns do you have about public health and individual rights? Give us a phone call, and let's begin with Henry, who joins us on the line from Augusta, Georgia.
Yes, my question is, in the very crowded urban centers in particular, should there be equipped internment centers for people with these very dangerous communicable diseases, not only for SARS, but in view of this biologic warfare threat?
Well, Henry, I don't believe that we want to go to internment centers, because it's important to understand that public health can't be a subterfuge for discrimination. And we've had very sad examples of that in our history. For example, at the turn of the 20th century, there was a mass quarantine in San Francisco, really an internment, but it was only made to operate against Chinese Americans. And so what we really want is to have humane, caring facilities for isolation where people can be treated and get food, clothing, and means of communication so that we deal with this as a public health rather than as a criminal matter.
And indeed, at the start of the AIDS epidemic, there were people who promoted similarly draconian measures to try to contain that.
Yeah, I mean, there were even senators who were calling for people with AIDS to be tattooed, to be forcibly confined, and the like. And so we really have to make sure that public health isn't used as a pretext for discrimination or arbitrary action. But if the science is there, there is every good reason to use appropriate public health powers.
Mm-hmm. Henry?
Yeah, or should the existing hospitals have specialized equipped units for this sort of thing?
They should, and that's one of my concerns about our current preparedness for infectious diseases, including bioterrorism, which is that at the moment, most hospitals will have at most a couple of what they call negative pressure rooms or isolation rooms. And that might be all right for a small outbreak, but for a large outbreak involving mass quarantine, I think we're badly prepared.
And negative pressure meaning it's not that they don't ask you hard questions, it's that the air pressure keeps everything in the room, so
very good.
Germs can't get out. Henry, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Bill, and Bill's on the line. He's in his car in Maryland.
Yes, hi, Neil.
Hi.
My question is there not in existence at this point a national standard of care that would have somewhat covered already what this law is about?
Yeah, you're talking about state laws. What about a national?
Well, it's a very good question, Bill. I mean, there is a national regulation or a federal regulation, and in fact, a couple of weeks ago, President Bush formally added SARS to the list of quarantinable diseases. But unfortunately, the federal law is actually just as antiquated as the state ones. It goes back a long way. There are also questions about its constitutionality because there are no clear rights to fair hearings, safeguards, and the like. And it only applies to quarantine. So there is really not a history of the federal government's involvement in infectious disease. It's always been a state power. But now we really do have to think about federal power, because in an age where case of infectious disease can travel from New York to San Francisco in no time at all, we really do need to have reasonably strong national authority.
Where are the lines? I mean, where is their state jurisdiction? Where is their federal jurisdiction?
It's a great question, Neil. I mean, it's what lawyers call a question of federalism. You know, when does the federal government have the right to act as opposed to the states? I think that's a real problem with our current laws, because there is no sorting device. But I think that on balance, the federal government should have priority when it's trying to deal with an international threat or a threat that involves multi-states and regions, whereas if it's primarily within a state, it should be mostly the state's concern.
Bill, thanks very much.
Yes, one other question, if you could, real quick. Isn't there an Emergency Medical and Treatment Act that comes under Medicare and Medicaid, which provides a national standard of care?
You might be talking about what lawyers call EMTALA, which it's really only a health care statute. It's not a public health statute, and it involves emergency treatment.
Okay, Bill, thanks very much for the call. We're talking about quarantine laws and civil liberties and infectious disease and bioterrorism. Chuckle fest. 800-989-8255. We'll be back after a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about state laws regarding quarantine. How do they work? How far-reaching are they? How effective might they be? Our guest here in Studio 3A is Lawrence Gostin, a law and public health professor at Georgetown University. Of course, you're invited to join the discussion. How far would you go to prevent the spread of contagious disease? Would you voluntarily stay home? And what would you do if you were ordered to? Give us a call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Lawmakers in California had to deal with some of these issues when an Emergency Health Powers Act almost came up for a vote there. It got bogged down in committee. Among the groups that opposed the act was the American Civil Liberties Union of California. They were concerned about due process and medical privacy. Also opposing the law was the California Healthcare Association. Jan Emerson is their spokeswoman, and she joins us now by cell phone from Capitol Hill here in Washington. And thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Why did your group oppose the law?
Well, we had two concerns with the bill. First, we do not believe that in all situations hospitals are necessarily the right place, particularly when you're talking about a situation involving smallpox. Smallpox, as you know, can be easily spread, and when you're coming into a hospital, if you have one person, you could easily spread it to everyone else in that hospital with very little effort. And you're already dealing with people who are immune systems are compromised, who are ill, and it could become quite a nightmare before you knew it. So from our perspective, when you're looking at quarantine locations in a situation like smallpox, we believe that you might want to look elsewhere, such as maybe an empty school gymnasium, something like that, where you could keep it very isolated and deal with the issue there. Our second concern with the bill was that it called for the state to have powers to come in and essentially take over the operation of a hospital. And while we are certainly very cooperative with state officials on a daily basis already, and we would be even more so in any kind of a disaster, having state officials, government workers, maybe even people who are trained in public health, come in and operate a hospital is not as easy as it might sound. Hospitals are a very complex facility to operate, and we felt that there may be all kinds of unintended consequences for someone who came in from a government agency trying to take over a hospital and not really sure what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. So those sound like pragmatic concerns of rather than great issues of rights.
Oh, absolutely. From our perspective, we were not focusing on the civil liberties issue. That's certainly not our area of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
Our area of expertise is the operation of hospitals, and it is a bottom line, a very pragmatic viewpoint. And I believe that there were a number of members on the Assembly Health Committee where this bill was debated that felt similarly. The bill did not make it out of that first committee, and so therefore died relatively early in its introduction.
Lawrence Gostin, I wondered if you would address those concerns.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I mean, the issue about quarantine not in hospitals actually does surprise me. If not in a hospital, then where? In a gymnasium, I don't think that a gymnasium would be better equipped to control the spread of disease than a hospital with trained workers, and I just think it defies common sense. I mean, it may be that you would need other places for isolation, but to rule out hospitals, I just don't see how that could fly, certainly not historically or pragmatically. Secondly, the idea of the state asking hospitals to take patients seems to me to be not something you would do lightly. You'd obviously not do it lightly, but if there was a state or a national emergency where hospital beds were clearly needed, this gives the power to do that. And again, what I realized in working on this law is that every industry claimed a special exemption. It wasn't just you in the hospital industry. It was pharmaceuticals, biotech, food, transportation. Everybody wanted to said it was a great idea, but not us.
Hmm. All right, Jan Emerson?
Well, I'm not sure that we said it was a great idea, but not us. Our viewpoint is we absolutely already work hand in hand with state officials in disaster situations. And in California, for good or for bad, we've had a lot of experience dealing with disasters over the last decade or so, earthquakes, floods, fires, riots. So we have a lot of experience in dealing with the state officials in disaster situations, mass casualty situations. So that is not the issue. It is a matter of wanting to keep a situation from exploding farther into the population than is necessary. And when we said, you know, it may be a gymnasium, it may be a hotel, who knows where it would be. And it's not that we wouldn't provide the healthcare workers. We certainly would. It is just that we don't want the patients who are already in the hospital, who are already very ill, and in one of the results of managed care, particularly in California, is that only the very sickest people are now hospitalized. So it's not like you've got people who are in there just for an extra day or so recuperating. You've got people who are very, very ill, and they would be susceptible to the spread of a communicable disease like a smallpox. So we are trying to look out for the best interests of all of our patients, and that's why we felt that looking at another location where we would certainly come in and provide the healthcare expertise might be in the best interest of all. Mm-hmm. We actually had proposed last year in the legislature a bill that would have allowed us to develop mobile field hospitals similar to MASH units that we could have in strategic locations throughout the state of California, that we could, within a very rapid period of time, probably not more than 24 hours, get up and running, be it for an earthquake, be it for a fire, be it for smallpox. That money to do that was not approved by the legislature last year, and given our current budget situation in the state of California, it's not likely that that will go anywhere in the near future either. But again, it's not an issue of us saying not us. It's an issue of saying we absolutely want to be involved, just we need to think about the broader health implications of all patients.
Okay, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Jan Emerson is a spokeswoman for the California Healthcare Association, and she was with us from Capitol Hill here in Washington, D.C., a corridor of power, literally. Let's go now to Marilyn, who joins us from Unity, Maine.
Yes. I just feel that if there's a problem of an epidemic, most assuredly the government should say to these people, you cannot go to this country. In fact, the plane should not go there. They have every right to do that. When you get on an airplane, you can infect so many people. And I understand not only that, the people along the way in the airports, the people at home when you come home. And the airplanes, I understand, have the air conditioning that just keeps going around and around, and you don't get fresh air. There are a lot of germs on airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel that should be made better for people, made more healthful for people.
Lawrence Gostin, doesn't there a law now that requires airliners or passenger liner ships to notify officials if there's somebody very sick aboard?
I actually don't think it's required, although they do often do that. But I think I wanted to just react to the caller's idea of keeping people from coming into the country. Julie Gerberding, the director of the CDC, I think quite rightly pointed out that we have two epidemics. We have a real epidemic of SARS, but we also have an epidemic of fear. And I don't think we want to overreact. We clearly don't want to use draconian measures of not letting people into the country. So
I was thinking of China.
Well, no, even still, you don't want to single out any one country or race or ethnicity because that's going down the wrong path.
Wasn't there a plane that got a notification on its way into California, I think, from China, and it turned out that people didn't have SARS?
Yeah, I mean, San Jose Airport quarantined the plane for a short period of time to rule out SARS.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, there are people just in our neighborhood, two towns away, that have recently gone over to China and back again, and I think that they should not have been allowed to do that because of the great epidemic that is over there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a travel advisory, but it's not mandatory. And as I say, you know, we don't want to overreact. We want to just maintain a level of strong confidence, calm, and tolerance.
That's true, but I think preventative measures. Well, really a bunch better than waiting until something happens.
Marilyn, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Joining us now from Boston is Dr. Alfred DeMaria, Director of Communicable Diseases for the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, and welcome to you.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Massachusetts is one of the states that has not passed the model law that our guest, Lawrence Gostin, authored, and why is that?
Well, I think it's definitely under discussion. I think when we look at what the laws are in Massachusetts that affect us, that we do have the powers necessary to implement reasonable disease control measures. It's just that they're sort of scattered among a number of statutes that sort of cross-refer to each other. And definitely there's a need for modernization, but I think in terms of dealing with something like SARS, we're in a very good position to apply measures as they're necessary to be applied.
Now, again, I think the United States thus far has gotten off very lightly on SARS, but I wonder if Massachusetts has ever had to mandate a quarantine in recent years.
Well, you know, it depends on, you know, I like to differentiate isolation. We're isolating someone with an infectious disease, an illness that's capable of being transmitted, versus quarantine, where you're really restricting someone who might be incubating a disease and may develop that disease. And we actually do that quite frequently, and I think it's because people think of quarantine, they think of putting people on boats in the harbor or moving them out to an island somewhere. But basically, when we say a child can't go to school if they're exposed to measles and haven't been immunized, or if we say that someone can't work in a healthcare facility because they're susceptible to chickenpox and we're exposed to chickenpox, we're actually applying a quarantine, and we actually are doing that under regulations that we have for that purpose.
Has anybody ever resisted an order?
Well, yeah, we do have some. It has happened, and especially back in the late 80s and early 90s where we restricted sporting events because of measles exposures on college campuses, we got a significant amount of resistance, but we basically had to station personnel at all the entrances to check people's immunization records before they were allowed into the event. So we have some experience with that. We have some experience with tuberculosis, which I think is an experience that all states have in certain cases. And we always try to apply the least restrictive measures to accomplish the goal of preventing disease transmission. So,
and again, that's on the question of the balance of public health and individual rights.
Exactly. We're always sort of very sensitive to that balance because I think, you know, an overreaction can be very disruptive and intrusive and can be counterproductive in many circumstances because it may cause more resistance or it may cause people to try to get around the measures that are required. So we really try to work with people to get voluntary compliance, and we're usually quite successful, especially when there's a significant element of danger. It's when people don't agree with our assessment of what that danger is that we sometimes run into controversy.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Alfred DeMaria is the Director of Communicable Diseases for the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, and he was with us from his office in Boston. We're still with Lawrence Gostin of Georgetown University, and he's with us here in Studio 3A, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I wanted to ask you, Lawrence Gostin, about that question. If you're over-responding, if the government, you know, overreacts, isn't there a problem of driving the disease underground where people refuse to cooperate and won't come in?
Yeah, and Dr. DeMaria was very sensible, I thought, in getting the balance right. You do have to get the balance right. You can't come in being heavy-handed, arbitrary, or using more force than's necessary. You've got to use the least restrictive alternative. And so your first option is not coercion. That's your last option. But it needs to be in the arsenal of the tools of a public health official. But you don't want to drive the epidemic underground. You don't want to stop people from getting tested and treated and because of fear.
We mentioned AIDS earlier. We got an email from Joe in Tallahassee. Something I've always wondered about, he writes, when AIDS first started to be recognized as a disease or syndrome, or even after there was a successful AIDS test, was there ever discussion of quarantine of persons with AIDS?
There was a discussion of quarantine with AIDS, and there were a few isolated cases of people with HIV infection who were isolated, but we soon realized most of us knew it at the time, but even the hard-wing politicians soon realized that it didn't make sense because it was a voluntary behavior. It wasn't casually transmissible, and the like. During our discussions, we did talk about Cuba, which is one example of a quarantine.
Now, there they were. AIDS cases were sent out to an island and isolated.
Well, yeah, they were. All people in Cuba who are HIV positive were separated from the population. They were given humane care and lots of attention, but it was highly draconian. Unfortunately, it was also, well, fortunately, it was effective, but at a cost that was too high, in my opinion.
Now let's go to our next caller, who is Genevieve, who's on the line with us from Petaluma, California.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have to say that I'm playing the devil's advocate here as a public health nurse and as a family nurse practitioner. And I just want to say that we haven't talked too much about the healthcare workers and their risks and rights as individuals and as service providers in the threat of diseases.
And certainly they were most at risk in SARS.
Exactly, and many of them have been killed by the disease. And it would be nice to hear some comments from the writer of the law about the healthcare worker, and I want to remind him of Hasib Aoun, a physician that I knew when he was a medical student in Costa Rica who died from a disease and his rights that were infringed upon as he left this world.
Lawrence Gostin?
Genevieve, it's an extremely important point that you've just made. Healthcare workers are on the front lines. One could see it, as Neil said, with SARS. You could also see it with smallpox vaccinations and the president's campaign to do that. The burden so often in epidemics is on healthcare workers. And in my opinion, healthcare workers have an ethical duty to treat in an infectious disease context. The American Medical Association agrees with that. But in exchange, we as a society need to do the very best we can to protect them, to provide adequate equipment and infection control and health care, as well as compensation and all the support we can give them. They are truly the soldiers on the front line, and we tip our hats to them.
Genevieve, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Lawrence Gostin, we appreciate your coming in today.
My pleasure.
Lawrence Gostin is director of the Center for Law and the Public's Health, a joint project of Johns Hopkins and Georgetown Universities, and he joined us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, longtime journalist and broadcaster Charles Osgood joins us to talk about funny letters from famous people and the lost art of letter writing. Have you ever written a letter or received one from a famous person? Tell us about it. Our phone number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, kind of a letter, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.